You're listening to No Plot, Only Lore, a podcast about games and the tables we play them at. Your DMs tonight and every night are Josh and Chris. You can find us on all podcast platforms or check us out at noplotonlylore.com. If you like what you hear today, please rate and review the show and share it with everyone you've ever met. Hey folks, welcome back to No Plot, Only Lore. You know, we spent a lot of time here in the last few weeks talking about games and their design and criticizing certain elements of them, but we wanted to kind of take a step back from getting into the weeds on specific systems and talk about the ideas of criticism and expression through expression of art through games in general, and so talk a little bit more about some of the terms that we've thrown out willy-nilly without good explanation.
Mostly me.
Because we feel like mostly you.
Mostly.
Because if, you know, there's, I think it's helpful for us to be on the same page as a community when it comes to, you know, the ideas that we're talking about as far as, you know, criticism of the systems for what they do and role playing games as a medium in general.
It's actually kind of funny that you say on the same page, because I know that like bad faith criticism is everywhere in role playing games, where like, if you don't like a specific system or something that's in a specific system, it's obviously crap, right? And like the metrics that we're using to criticize those games are, does this thing do exactly the thing that I want it to do? And that just doesn't actually work when trying to get on the same page about game criticism, but...
Yeah, let's talk about criticism as a subject for a bit here. You know, obviously, both of us are highly opinionated people.
Yep.
But there's a big difference between having a strong opinion about something and providing legitimate criticism of it.
Right.
You can be critical of something, but that doesn't mean it's necessarily criticism. So, you know, Chris, you have a little bit more experience in this area. Why don't you sort of lay the groundwork for that?
Yeah, so let's dust off my art school diploma a little bit. And what do you know coming into this about like the world of art criticism or like professional criticism?
I know a little bit more about professional criticism in general than specifically art criticism.
Okay.
I've worked in artistic mediums that are open to criticism, especially in the theater and improv mm-hmm. worlds, and comedy writing in general, but art criticism I feel is a little more specific than general like criticism of creative endeavors, because it has a little more structure in a lot of ways that take it back from looking at the content, which is mm-hmm. what people typically think of when it comes to criticism. You know, did I enjoy the jokes in this stand-up special? Did I enjoy the pace of this movie? And looking at the structure of the piece and whether or not it was competently executed. But I don't have a lot of first-hand experience on that side of things.
Okay. So art criticism from like the school that I came from in art criticism is it's a practical application of the philosophy of aesthetics. Right, the idea that we can understand and break down why something is beautiful, why something is nice to look at, why something is bad to look at, why something sounds nice, why it doesn't sound nice. And trying to figure out how to communicate more objective ideas about that thing so that other people can get an idea of whether or not they might enjoy it. Right, so it's a little bit divorced from the idea of liking or not liking a particular piece, and a lot more about like trying to break it down into easily recognized ideas that you can then apply to other things. So like if you're looking at like when most people think about art criticism, the first thing they think about is like criticizing a painting, right?
Mm-hmm.
And like you'll often hear people who are like pretending to be art critics on TV being like, yes, it draws the eye. But like, what does drawing the eye actually mean? And it's actually like a pretty set, defined list of things that are going to happen. Like the way that a particular angle moves across a painting is going to pull your eye as you're looking at it in that direction. And then a different angle is going to pull your gaze in a different direction. And then moving your eye around the painting, that's what it means to draw the eye. Right. And so
right.
figuring out all of these like component pieces and the design pieces and all of the different techniques that are used and the feelings that it's evoking, that's kind of what we're talking about when we're talking about like art criticism.
I see. Yeah. So just to make a poor analogy, but it seems like art criticism would be the difference between like, you know, someone criticizing the story of a movie versus someone who is looking at like the competent editing of a movie and like, does this person know how to like frame a shot as a cinematographer, the more technical side of things.
That's actually kind of interesting because I think that film criticism is just a branch of art criticism, right? So like when I'm talking about art criticism, I'm not just talking about like visual art. I'm talking about like all art, and you can apply it to right. like performance art, the theater, the things that are happening with like the buskers on the street. All of that can be critiqued using art criticism, and like
gotcha.
The branches of that are going to be things like here's your theater criticism, right? And the theater critics are going to be looking at like how are people emoting, how are they communicating the story effectively.
Okay, yeah, so just going back from the theater criticism to the movie one, then it'd be like mm-hmm. you've got the screenwriting, your editing, your sound production, that kind of stuff. Those would be different components of overall art criticism mm-hmm. as specific to movies.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
And it has nothing to do with what the director was trying to say or something.
Well, it might have something to do with what the director is trying to say. Like the...
Well, no, I'm saying like when we talk about art criticism, though, we're not necessarily talking about like, I guess if we're talking about like visual arts or whatever, like, okay, when I hear art, I always think of like, oh, this would be hanging in the MoMA or mm-hmm. whatever, right? Like, are you saying they're just criticizing the technical application, or are they actually criticizing like, hey, here's what the artist was intending to express, and what did they do a good job of communicating that?
Well, the interesting thing about the intending to express is the idea that's come out in the last like 200 years of like death of the author, right? Like whether or not there should be a separation when critiquing a piece of art between the intention of the creator, whatever that might be, with the text of the art piece itself, right? So like if we're looking at the intent of the director when looking at a film, then we're accepting that death of the author in that case is not something that we're accepting, I guess. That's a
right,
weird way to put that.
Right.
But we're accepting that like the intent of the director is something that is important in this critique of the thing that we're doing. But we don't have to, right? We can remove the director entirely and just go by the technical accomplishments of the piece and just read the text instead. So that's actually kind of an ongoing argument in art criticism right now, is like whether or not we should be paying attention to the creator's intent when
yeah,
looking at a piece.
Like, yeah.
Not to, like, drag out recent drama or whatever, but, like, death of the author has become a huge deal in, like, literary criticism around authors like J.K. Rowling, most recently. Orson Scott Card is another one who, like, 10 or 15
right.
years ago, everybody realized he was a person who did not like the gays. And, like, whether or not we need to be reading their work within the context of their real-world opinions. And so that has just, like, restarted that debate in a huge way recently.
Okay, so that seems like two different issues, though. I mean, like, there's death of the artist, I guess, in the sense of does their, like... IRL activity affect the, you know, the in-game production or whatever, you know, or on the other hand, there's the intent of the art piece itself. Like
right.
if Orson Scott Card is not making Ender's Game with the intention of shitting on the gays,
mm-hmm.
then like, is that important to note, or do we still have to look at whatever he made there under the context of, by the way, remember, this guy doesn't like gay people.
Well, and that's part of where that argument is most interesting, for me anyway, is like, not necessarily to use Orson Scott Card in this case, but like, let's look at somebody like H.P. Lovecraft, right? He has notoriously terrible morals and wrote some absolutely incredible pieces of art. Do we need to view his art through the lens of him being a terrible person? Or do we accept the art as it is, just based on the text of that art? Right? And so
it's
not necessarily like the intention of the piece, it's also like figuring out how a artist's personal life, how their feelings and their morals would impact and affect the work that they're doing regardless.
Right, right. Like, can, like, can someone make a piece of art that goes against how they feel or behave as a person and still be valid?
I mean, absolutely they can.
If that makes sense.
But as critics, right, when we're looking
at that's
art,
what I'm saying. Like,
do we need to take that into consideration?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Some people say,
can a piece of art exist in a void of context, or does everything have to be viewed through the lens of, like, through the context of who was this person, what were they trying to say, and what were they trying to do or say outside of this piece in general?
Right.
Because that has an effect on the art that they put out.
So, like, an example of that would be, like, if H.P. Lovecraft writes a scene where a black man is tortured, how important is it that we know that H.P. Lovecraft was racist? Right?
Right.
Because it could be that that scene, divorced from those opinions, is very impactful and works for the story. But we also have to consider that H.P. Lovecraft was racist. So, like...
Right, right.
How do we...
Like, does this scene only exist because he likes the idea of a black guy getting tortured?
Exactly.
Or was it actually, like, part of the whole story, regardless of how he felt about the end?
Yeah. Yeah. So, ongoing debate. Everybody has a different opinion on it. I'm not going to share mine, because I am divorcing myself from this work.
Yeah, please don't judge this work under the context of who I am as a person.
Oh, no.
I've got some skeletons. No, I'm kidding.
He doesn't even keep them in the closet. There's no room anymore.
They've piled up. They're falling out of the Hoosier that I was stuffing them into.
All right, so role-playing games are art. And this is not a thing that I am brooking argument on. Oh.
Okay.
Okay, hold up. Do you have opinions?
Yes and no.
All right.
So the idea of whether or not role-playing games are art, I guess, comes back to the general supposition of whether or not games as a medium are art. Because on the one hand, I fully support the idea that, like, video games are art. Some video games are art.
Oh, shit. All right. We're getting spicy.
Yeah.
Which video game isn't art, Josh?
Call of Duty. but just taking a shot at the big dog. Sued into oblivion. I can appreciate that there is artistic expression in gaming mediums, whether it's role-playing games, tabletop board games, video games, things like that. There are definitely times where it's definitely art and someone's definitely trying to artistically do something. But when it comes, like, they're telling a story, they're trying to express an opinion or educate people. But for me, when it comes to role-playing games specifically, I hesitate to just full-blown call them art, because I feel like we're on a slippery slope where if role-playing games are art, that's dangerously close to saying that improv is an art, and it's fucking not.
Right. So, your opinions of improv aside. Man, I'm putting some sort of, like, crack at improv on your gravestone. Like, it's going to be...
Yeah, that's fine. I can make these comments given how much stupid time I spent doing it. But, you know, for me, there's got to be a definition or a delineation, I guess, in the difference between, like, art and just, like, artistic expression.
Right.
Like,
I am willing to posit.
You can definitely... Yeah, go ahead.
I am willing to posit that any artistic expression is art. The caliber of that artistic expression is irrelevant to whether or not you have created art. The art, the practice of the art and the object of the art are sufficient for it to be an art.
Okay.
So I feel like those things kind of need some definition. Right. In the... Let's talk about specifically painting. Right?
Yeah.
The painting object, the object of the art of painting, is a painting, a picture that you can look at. The practice of the art is the creation of that painting.
Yeah.
Right. Both of those things are artistic. Both of those things are, in my opinion, art.
Okay.
For role-playing games... The art object is the story that the group of people put together, and I believe that storytelling is an art, 100%. Right? In-person live storytelling, absolutely an art. The story that you put together is the art object. The playing of the game is the art performance. Right? And the medium of the art piece is... agency.
Right.
So, C. Ty Nguyen wrote a great book about games as agency, like games agency as art, where the playing of games, and this is divorced from role-playing games. This isn't like role-playing game specific. This is just any game. The artistic medium of a game is making choices, expressing your agency, expressing your opinion and thought and strategy on the game. Other than chess. Chess doesn't matter.
Ah, good. Another chess hater.
I think we've established that we're both against the idea of chess as a game. Solved games don't count.
Yeah.
Nope. But yeah, like the expression of your art in that case is like expressing your agency, expressing your will onto the agreed upon rules of the game.
Right.
So that is where I'm coming from. When I say that games are art, I'm not just talking about role-playing games, I'm talking about all games. And because role-playing games are games, role-playing games are art.
Uh-huh. I see. I guess for me it comes down to this complicated idea of, like, when does art count as art? And I'm kind of the dickhead opinion that bad art isn't art. the only problem comes when you need to define, well, what counts as bad art. And for me, the deciding factor for whether or not art is good or bad is me. I am the adjudicator of all art.
Well, and that...
So...
Like, when we're talking about criticism, the object of criticism, like, the attempt of criticism, is to provide an objective view of all of these different things that we're talking about. Right? Like, we're trying to discuss this painting in a way that doesn't really take our opinion of the quality into account. Right? So... When I say that this is a thing that I didn't like but is good, right, that to me is me separating my opinion of the thing from the quality of the art. Right? Sure. So I did not like The Big Lebowski. I recognize that The Big Lebowski is good.
Right. Okay.
Right. So regardless of my opinion on it, the thing has quality. Right. It matches all of these, like all of the various bits and pieces of the thing come together in a way that I recognize as being good quality art. I just didn't like it.
Yeah. Yeah, and
which is funny because I quote it all the time.
It's a very quotable movie.
It is.
And I think I have an easier time understanding that type of criticism when it comes to specifically games and role-playing games.
Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously we're both TTRPG players, but I also spend a huge amount of time in the board game space,
mm-hmm.
Probably more than role-playing games. Actually, definitely more. But for myself, I'm definitely able to look at a well-made, competent game and say, that's a good game, just not my thing.
Right.
And I'm getting better at that, I think, in the role-playing space as well, as I get exposed to more systems and be like, oh, okay, this is a competently put-together system that, you know, does what its objective is. Mm-hmm. I just don't like what it's trying to do.
Well, and that's such a hard thing to do, right? Like, the biggest thing that I see in, like, pop criticism, right? Like, whenever I'm looking at, like, criticism of TV shows or movies on, like, YouTube, or, like, the whole idea of, like, the video essay, one of the things that will automatically shut me down from a criticism is the placement of a quality judgment without any qualifiers to it, right? So, like,
right.
I'm an animator. I went to school for animation, and one of the things that I see come up constantly in animation criticism is this idea that there's a specific school or type of cartoon that is doing well that is just crap, right? And it's referred to as the CalArts style by the people who believe in this thing, and that term was coined by John Crisfalusi way back in the day. He made Ren and Stimpy and is a terrible human being. But the idea was that, like, everybody was copying what Disney was doing because Disney owned CalArts, the school that everybody was going to for animation.
I see,
and
yeah.
And so all of the animation that was coming out looked the same, which meant that it was bad, right? It didn't have a proper movement. And, like, Crisfalusi's criticism of the CalArts style was not a great criticism, but it did have, okay, like, the qualities of criticism. Like, it did attempt to be objective in what it was doing. But everything that's come after that, like, the people who, like, spout about this on YouTube are just like, yeah, the CalArts style is crap. Everybody has, like, the same shape of heads, and everybody has, like, thin lines, and nobody moves, and they're just wrong.
Yeah.
They're just wrong and bad. Right.
Yep.
They're not actually attempting to put any quality on the thing that they think is wrong or bad. They're just saying, I don't like this, so it sucks.
Yeah, yeah. They can't give a detailed, like, editorialized reason, right, why these specific elements are bad.
Right. Yeah. So, one of the things, like, bringing this back to role-playing games a bit, or, like, games in general, is that in the 1990s, there was this, like, big push to begin to criticize role-playing game design in similar ways to the ways that we were criticizing movies and literature and art.
Okay, yeah.
And one of the big proponents of that was a website called The Forge. It was a forum that was run by Ron Edwards and, like, a cohort of other game designers. And they started to really break down what role-playing games are and how they work.
Right, yeah.
And they had a vested interest, right? Like, they were designing these things. They wanted to understand, like, how do I make a thing good if I don't have objective markers that I can reach for to say that a thing is good?
Sure.
Right. So, like, along with heavily borrowing from literary criticism. Because again, because role-playing games is such a narrative art form, right? Because it relies so much on storytelling, a lot of the criticism tools that we use have been cribbed from literature, right? So we're critiquing stories, we're critiquing plot lines, but it all kind of falls apart at the point where, like, role-playing games don't have to end. And so trying to define, like, a plot graph for a role-playing game that's gone on for, like, 12 years doesn't make a lot of sense.
Yeah, definitely.
Right, so kind of had to have our own language for it. We were kind of trying to look for, like, ways that we could criticize these games that made a bit more sense. And so they started, like, breaking that shit down in a big way. So that's where GNS theory first came about. And for people who are unfamiliar with GNS, it's the idea that any situation that happens in a game can be broken down into one of three categories. It's either a gamist situation, we're attempting to play the game. It's a narrativist situation, so we're trying to tell the story in this particular chunk of time. Or it's a simulationist situation. And so we're trying to, like, simulate reality. We're trying to have logical conclusions to actions. We're trying to have, like, consequences that make sense. And
right.
External, what is that called? Consistency. External consistency. Right. So, like, things that happen in the game are the things that would happen outside of the game too. So I jump off the roof. Okay. You fall down and hit the ground. That's a simulationist situation.
Sure.
Right. That's where we got the Lumpley principle, which is one of my favorite ideas in role-playing games, which is that the system of a role-playing game is what we have agreed to.
Right.
So when you sit down at a role-playing game table, yeah, you have this gigantic book of rules that you can play with, and those rules exist. They are part of the art object, or one of the art objects of role-playing games. And, like, to be clear, role-playing games have, like, a bunch of different art objects. They've got, like, the books and the dice and the minis, and, like, all of that is still part of the art and can be. But you have that book that has all of the rules in it, but then the system itself is also, like, how do we determine who talks when?
Yeah.
Right? What types of situations are we going to agree to be in? What type of game did we agree to run? Right? Which house rules are we using?
Yeah.
Right. All of that adds up to become system, which is what, whenever you see any of these, like, highbrow discussions about role-playing games, whenever they're talking about system, they're not just talking about the rules in the book, right? They're also talking about the peripheral agreements that we have in that space.
Definitely.
So, and then the one that we're going to hammer on the most, and the one that I keep coming back to over and over again, is the idea of shared imagined space.
Yeah. You've brought this up several times, and I, with context clues, sort of knew what was going on, but let's,
yeah.
Listen, my whole life is faking I know what's going on with context clues, so.
All right, so, why don't you break down for me what you understand shared imagined space to be, and then we can go from there.
Okay, I guess in the broadest terms, it is the shared imagined space would be the sort of world that you all have constructed and agreed to the definition and boundaries of and are inhabiting with a consistent internal logic as a group. So, you know, understanding that, let's say we're playing in a Dark Sun campaign, the idea that, like, you know, we're setting ourselves up, and we all understand magic is rare and dangerous, and we'll behave appropriately, and you know, we understand, like, what from general descriptions things are supposed to look like and might not look like, and could and couldn't be possible based on the rules that we've established from the get-go.
That is real heckin' close.
Okay.
So shared imagined space is cribbed from storytelling academia. So, there are entire branches of schools that are looking into like storytelling and how does storytelling work. And one of the things that they came on was this idea that when you get a group of people together and you describe something to those people, they all more or less imagine the same thing. Right. And it's
okay.
The details of that thing tend to be pretty consistent from person to person, right? Like if you go around a storytelling circle with a bunch of kids and you've heard somebody tell a story and you ask them about details about what they saw or what the story had in it, right? They'll all tell you more or less the same things.
Right. Depending on what you've told them.
And clarity in your descriptions is going to be very important for that. So like if you describe a thing and one of the kids says that they imagined a teddy bear in the bedroom and one of them says that they imagined it was a stuffed rabbit, right? That lack of clarity in that case means that there's like a disparity a bit in the shared imagined space, right?
So
like more clarity is necessary there. But it comes down...
I guess like, or not, depending on what you're doing with the space?
Or not, yeah. And, like, role-playing games deal with this shit all the time, right? Like, that disparity of information where, like, you're imagining that everybody is in a dark alley and one guy says, okay, I pick up a pipe, right? If I wasn't imagining a pipe, I want to know where the pipe came from. Or I'll just accept that there's a pipe now, right? And I'll edit my idea of the shared imagined space on the fly based on that new information that's been added.
Yeah.
Right. And it kind of, it breaks down into like the collective imagination, like the ideas that everybody has of the characters, the situation, the setting, the color and flavor of what's going on, and the system. Right. And again, we're going back to that Lumpley principle of like system being the stuff that we've all agreed to. Right.
Yeah.
So when we sit down and we start thinking about like the text of the game, right? Like the stuff that the DM is describing, or if it's a DM free game, then like the stuff that everybody is describing. We start to vividly hallucinate the same things unless you don't have a visual imagination, which again, I'm still trying to get over.
Right. Yeah. The weirdos who just like have no, I can't even imagine a world without like that internal visualization, but I know they exist.
Right.
Like monsters.
Yeah. And actually I think that that's an interesting avenue for exploration on shared imagined space. Like if I was a storytelling scholar, I would be finding as many of these people as I could to try and understand how and why they enjoy stories.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Like that's just so fascinating to me, because like the reason that I enjoy stories is because like books, I stare at a dead tree and vividly hallucinate for 4 hours, right? Like I am seeing stuff that's going on in my head. I don't understand.
Yeah, well, I mean,
go ahead.
Yeah, it's just like for my example, I mean, like one of my favorite authors ever is a guy named Dan Abnett. He he wrote a lot of the newer Guardians of the Galaxy stuff, but he's also written a lot of Black Library books for Games Workshop. And in fact, he was writing the big like conclusion of their Horus Heresy saga that's been going on for like 20 years now. But what I like about his writing is how good he is at like painting a picture with words that I then see in my mind, like in vivid detail. Like his descriptions of there's just the way he describes like movement and combat in a scene are like unlike any other author I've read. He has a knack for getting you to move with the characters through a scene in a way that lets you know explicitly what's going on without just sitting there and bombarding you with words. Right.
Well, I feel kind of the same way about like Robert Jordan's writing. Like, not necessarily with the action stuff, because his action stuff wasn't nearly as good, but, like, the weird amount of description that is in the Wheel of Time books is something that really, like, sets my imagination up. And, like, I can describe for you what a leather leaf tree looks like, right? Like,
right.
They don't exist. Right, but I have heard the description of leather leaves so goddamned often that I know more about that tree than I know about actual trees that exist. I feel like I cut out there.
Yeah, you definitely did. Sorry.
Oh, okay.
No, I get what you're going for there. Like, funnily enough, I have a friend who is a Robert Jordan super fan. Mm-hmm. I tried to read Robert Jordan, mm-hmm. and the reasons you gave for loving it are why I couldn't stand it.
Yeah.
Because it felt like I was just sitting there having like stupid details described to me that didn't actually like put me in the scene and help me move through things. It was someone describing a painting to you, mm-hmm. if you were blind, and not like looking at, you know, Starry Night and like feeling something in your chest. It was really strange.
I needed desperately to live anywhere but Stettler, Alberta. And
that's, I think that's a big part of it.
Yeah. So like, being able to very clearly visualize literally everything that was happening in that book was very key to my enjoyment of reading at the time.
Okay, yeah. And see, funnily, like, I was once asked to edit a book for a guy who, I don't know if he ever read another book, but he spent the better part of 2 pages right at the start of the book of describing in excruciating detail the foyer of a house,
right,
which I don't need to tell you is not the most like gripping setting. And that's, I got that feeling again reading Robert Jordan. It was just like, oh, this guy wants to tell me about the fucking banisters again.
Every time I walk into a foyer, I feel the call to adventure, Josh. That, yeah, I need more of that in my life, for sure. Just foyers.
Yeah, well, maybe that's described. Just the, like, yeah, you escape by being able to imagine a setting that isn't Stettler, Alberta, and I escape by imagining that I am a religious fanatic inquisitor hunting down heretics and demons.
See, that isn't so, like, separate from the truth.
It explains so much about us.
Are you super excited about the movie?
I am so stoked at the idea, and I think that at least one of the people involved in the project knows what's best, but I, having seen promises be made and broken,
you can just call it The Witcher.
Decades now. Yeah, it's just like like I'm trying to not let myself have hope, because then I can't be hurt again.
Yeah,
but I so desperately want to be that like happy again that I can be hurt.
Yeah, we all want seasons 1 through 3 of Game of Thrones again for the first
time. I'll even add season four. It was rocky, but
season 4 was okay. It felt like the rough season before you get back to the good stuff, and then that was not the case.
Yeah, it was like the filler season instead of like the beginning of a slope downhill into oblivion.
Yeah, anyway, role-playing games, that's the thing that we're supposed to talk about.
Yeah.
So, like, shared imagined space has a lot of different ways you can put it together. And, like, a lot of it is going to come from, again, agreement, right? Agreement around the table about what is happening. And this is a little bit where, like, some of the arguments about, like, minis versus theater of the mind come in, right? Where, like, some people have an easier time understanding or navigating through shared imagined space than others, right? So, like, for me to imagine myself 5 feet away from an orc while there's a couple of goblins behind me that are, like, 20 feet away, right? That's not a hard thing for me to keep track of in the shared imagined space for myself, but I know that there are a lot of people who have some difficulty with that.
Yeah.
And so, like,
well, and the thing for me is, like, I like 5, 10 feet. Okay, great. But as soon as you get further out from that, and I'm trying to like figure out where everybody is in a room, like the idea of 20 feet is just like, I don't know. Is it like, is he across the room? Like, I think 20 feet might be me to my door, maybe, but I don't know how to properly express dimensions, and stuff like that is kind of important when it comes to like combat in Dungeons and Dragons. Like, you need to know that, am I 30 feet away from him or 50 feet away?
It's actually funny. And the way that my shared imagined space issues come in is with height. I can absolutely imagine a thing that's 10 feet tall. Imagining a thing that's 20 feet tall, objectively, I know it's not 20 feet tall. Like, I'm looking at a thing that's 30 feet tall or more.
Yeah.
But in my head, that's what 20 feet tall looks like. And anything taller than that, right? Like, you get to, like, a 40-foot tall thing, right? In my head, I'm thinking Tyrannosaurus, but I know that a Tyrannosaurus is smaller than 40 feet. Maybe? I don't know.
You might want to Google that.
But how tall is a Tyrannosaurus?
As, like, okay, so speaking as a 10-foot tall thing,
right.
Yeah, like, I know roughly that, like, 10 feet is roughly a building, like, mm-hmm. or like one story, yep. right? I know 10 feet is about a story. Everything over 10 feet is 100 feet.
Unless it's 1,000
feet. It does not matter. Yeah, it's 5 feet.
Yeah.
It's 10 feet. It's 100 feet. It's a kilometer.
Yeah.
Like, there's no, that's it.
Speaking of, like, the jump to 1,000, one of the things that I've been really enjoying lately is, like, looking at bad fantasy stuff where things were happening, like, 1,000 years in the past.
Oh, yeah.
It's just, like, if you look at some of the craziest shit that's happened in human history, it was 200 years ago.
Yeah, or even, like, some of the most insane conflicts and things like that that are, like, long, drawn-out affairs, and you're like, oh, this was 10 years.
Right?
Like,
World War II was only, like, 6 years long or something, right?
Like, yeah, exactly. World War II was, like, less time than it takes a child to, like, get a basic grasp of the world.
It was shorter than the war in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
yeah.
That's crazy. And it was one of the biggest world-defining moments in modern history. And it only happened, like, less than 100 years ago.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. A kid born at the start of World War I couldn't have gone to school by the time it was over.
Yeah.
Like.
Yeah. Old enough to go and fight in World War II, though.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and it's funny you mentioned that, because this ideas like this came up just recently. I don't know if you saw, but Denis Villeneuve said that he is not doing more than 3 Dune movies.
Good.
And I think a big part of the problem is that when you talk about God Emperor of Dune, they're talking about a guy who apparently ruled for 3,500 years,
yeah.
which is just like just a stupid amount of time to try and conceptualize. Mm-hmm. And then the idea that like you can have any sort of narrative continuity other than, hey, the weird worm guy's still here is,
except
like,
now it has a face in it.
Yeah, like this is what they meant by Dune is unfilmable.
Yeah.
Not the first couple books, this part.
Yeah. No, and like also that book is just so internal.
It's so much like just like dialogue and internal conversations.
Yeah, like so much internal dialogue happens in that book, or it's just like people are talking to themselves about like deep philosophical nonsense. It's lovely.
Yep.
I really enjoyed God Emperor of Dune. But
great book, terrible movie.
Yeah. I mean, you could turn it into like a 3-hour long navel gazing like Art Nouveau piece.
You know, if you just had someone like Christoph Waltz monologuing for 3 hours, I think you could pull it off.
Yeah. I think we need to pitch this to Denis Villeneuve.
Like, listen, I know you've already publicly said you're not doing more than 3 movies.
But we got a great idea.
I appreciate the work you've done so far. Want to do something? Would you like to do the funniest thing ever?
We just go in with, like, fucking jazz hands being like, you're never going to believe this idea. It's going to be so boring.
They said it was unfilmable. Would you like to just pull the biggest bait and switch in the history of the film medium?
Good.
Forget visual spectacle. It's just going to be a tight shot on one guy's head.
We'll have two sets. There's going to be two sets in Dune 4. It'll be the outside and the inside. So it'll be like a little desert surrounded by a bunch of forest. And then inside a room where the clones are.
I think more people should hire us to pitch movies.
Right? Yeah, this is Hollywood. We're waiting.
I'm so available.
Shared imagined space in role-playing games. Mostly determined by agreement, right? Like, everybody is going to be, like, discussing what is going to be happening, how it's happening, what it looks like, the flavor of the entire area, right? This is where, like, when you have somebody describe their character for the first time, it's so important to get, like, some visual information from them, right? Like, so often, when you ask somebody to describe their character, they're going to tell you, like, what their race and class is, right? And the stuff they're carrying, the stuff that they're wearing, right?
Yeah.
But it's so important to get, like, an idea of what this person looks like so that you can imagine that person more fully.
Yeah.
Right. And then depending on the game that you're playing, there may be an aspect of authority to the shared imagined space. Like, Dungeons and Dragons has a clear, like, authority. This is the person who decides the right and the wrong of the shared imagined space, right? The DM is the adjudicator, right?
Yeah.
But then you've got games like Fiasco, where there isn't a DM, and it's just, like, you and you pick two people, and you have a scene together, right? And the three of you are going to create that shared imagined space together.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. So, like, the authorship of the shared imagined space is often just, like, whatever you've agreed to at the table, right? Lumpley principle, whatever the system says your shared imagined space is going to be.
Yeah.
And then I think, like, the one thing that's a little confusing to get your head around with shared imagined space is, like, the limitations of it, where, like...
Uh-huh.
Shared imagined space can't have plot.
No.
Right, because plot exists as a layer outside of that. It's an understanding of the story that's being told within the shared imagined space, but it isn't actually in the shared imagined space.
Right.
Right, or like themes, right? Like, you can't necessarily have, like, running themes or... trying to think of a way to, like... describe that, like, anything that you're coming back to, like, the things that you're hearkening to, the emotions that you're trying to get out of it, or have to be experienced by somebody outside of the shared imagined space.
Yeah.
Right, so you have your character who is inside that shared imagined space, you have your imaginary space that you're creating there, but then you, as the person who's perceiving this art, you're going to be the one that's experiencing the plot and the themes.
Yeah. Yeah, ironically, this is, like, it's literally only lore in the space.
Yeah. Yeah, it's no plot, only lore.
Yep, just lore.
So that's some of the stupid shit that I talk about all the time.
Yeah, no, it's good to have a, well, funnily enough, it's good for us to help define the shared imagined space of the pod when we're referencing these things, you know, over and over in our discussion of you know, games in general and you know, the philosophy behind it.
Well, like, the reason that I keep just coming back to shared imagined space is just because, like, it is so vitally important to how we experience these games.
Sure.
Right, like, understanding what is happening within shared imagined space, like, that is the, well, one of the art objects of the game, right? That is the experience that you are all having together as players and as characters in this game.
Yeah.
It's also a definitely. Really helpful metagaming tool.
Yeah, definitely. Yes. Yes.
Right, like, it's so much...
Metagaming doesn't have to be a bad word.
No, and, like, if you are concerned about people using, like, player knowledge versus character knowledge, right? Character knowledge is just the stuff that's happening in the shared imagined space.
Yeah. Right?
Player knowledge... Players have knowledge of all sorts of shit that the characters don't. Right? And it's okay for that to be the case, because you are a separate participant. You're the audience portion of the shared imagined space that is the art object. So.
Yeah. Definitely.
Anyway, this one got really heady, and I just monologued for, like, a really long time.
That's okay. That's okay. I feel like... Sometimes we need the adult to take over for a bit and talk about adult things instead of me just making dick jokes and, you know, leveling unfounded accusations about the quality of various games
yeah.
and apparently art pieces.
Yeah. Yeah. What was the art that you said was bad?
Improv.
Right, all of improv. It. Improv is bad, and Call of Duty isn't art.
The only part of Call of Duty that's art is when you got to shoot those kids in the airport or whatever it was.
Hey, thanks for making it all the way through this episode of No Plot, Only Lore. If you're looking for more, you can always find us at noplotonlylore.com and on all the very best podcast platforms. If you like what you heard today, please share, rate, and review the show to feed my never-ending need for attention and validation.